Now we're going to go into the far reaches of the human mind. How far do we go? In a moment, Stephen Schwartz joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Schwartz, Research Associate of Cognitive Sciences Laboratory of the Laboratories of Fundamental Research, is one of the world's experts on the practical applications of remote viewing and other aspects of extraordinary human functioning. You know, for almost 20 years, he was the research director and chairman of the Mobius Society. The laboratory carried out research into remote viewing, creativity, therapeutic intent, and other areas of human performance. And he's also the author or co-author of more than 30 technical papers, 4 books, and numerous magazines. And pieces of that, articles that went into them. Stephen is the editor of the Schwartz Report, an international daily web publication as well. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Stephen, welcome back. How are you?
How are you, George?
I'm doing great. And you look like you've been keeping very busy.
Well, I've been keeping moderately busy, yes. Yes, I've got Opening to the Infinite out, my new book, and we're continuing to work on the gold standard course, and so I'm trying to make information about non-local consciousness available to people.
I love the cover of Opening to the Infinite. As a little boy, strange story, I was thumbing through a kid's book. Gosh, I must have been 5 years old, Stephen. And I was mesmerized by a picture of a little boy reading a book next to his window. It was a bay window that had a shelf, a big enough shelf where a kid could just lie down on it.
Right.
And he was reading his book under the moonlight. And this picture just captured me. And this artist's rendition that you have of the lake looking like it's going into an ocean and the sun kind of reminds me a little bit about that. It just brings back great memories.
Well, that was done by a very well-known artist named Jonathan Meter, and who's an old friend. And I asked him if I could use that image, and it also has that Escher quality.
Yeah.
As the top of the window frame dissolves and you don't know which is cloud. Jonathan was gracious enough to let me use it. But thank you.
Opening to the Infinite, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I've gone through a lot of developments in my own consciousness and my own thinking about this, even since the last time we talked. And I increasingly am coming to see this as a capacity that all of us have to open to a realm of consciousness that is outside of time-space, and where not only can we obtain information, do we open to information, but we also have the capacity to affect other systems, either through what we call healing or therapeutic intention, and that we are interacting with one another in a variety of ways that we just are beginning to dimly understand.
Now, tell me what you feel to be the difference or similarities between non-local consciousness and non-local awareness. What is that?
Well, I think of non-local awareness as the personal experience. It's that moment, and it may have been that moment when you saw the picture of the boy on the ledge.
Uh-huh.
It's that moment that people have when they suddenly feel a connection to a greater whole. It's the kind of experience the religious ecstatic or the genius has. It's that personal connection with a greater whole, which I think of as non-local consciousness, which is the aggregate of all consciousness.
How did you, Stephen, get involved in all this?
Well, I got involved with it because I had an experience that, or a series of experiences that forced me to confront the idea that there really was a part of us that was not just trapped inside of our brains, because I had, like anybody who'd gone through a research training, I mean, I had come to think of consciousness as just something going on in the brain. It was no brain, no consciousness. And I came to realize, I sort of confronted it, that you really, if you looked at the data honestly, you had to acknowledge that something was going on, that some part of us exists outside of time-space. The near-death studies the reports about reincarnation, the reports of precognitive dreams that people have, all that stuff. When you really forget about all the trappings about it and just look at what is the nature of this experience, you come away with the idea that there is a part of us that exists outside of time-space.
You know, it's almost as if consciousness, and I believe this, exists outside of the brain, not in the brain.
Well, Wilder Penfield, who was one of the developers of brain mapping a number of years ago, in his final book, Mysteries of the Mind, wrote that whatever the brain was, it was not the mind, that you could hurt the brain and hurt the mechanism, but that did not mean that you hurt the operator. And I think it's actually a synthesis of both. There is a portion of the mind that is brain-specific, and there are other portions of consciousness which endure independent of the brain itself.
I'm beginning to wonder, Stephen, if the mind maybe just kind of floats around your body on the exterior portion of your body.
Well, there are a number of people have thought that. I do think a part of the brain is stored in the neuroanatomy of the brain.
True.
That part of consciousness is stored within the neuroanatomy
right.
of the brain. But, you know, if you look at everything from how do savants know what they know? How do kids who are 3 years old start writing symphonies? I mean, that's a complicated skill set. Where does that come from? It's not like you're just, it's sort of hardwired into you. When a child comes back with a particular injury, and says, well, I got this injury in a previous life because I was killed by a man with an axe as I was climbing out of my lover's window. And he has this kind of injury, and they go back, and sure enough, there was a person of that name, and that's exactly what happened to him. When you look at the near-death studies, people who have been clinically brain dead, and yet they report, as you've had many people on, I'm sure, on the
mm-hmm.
show, what is that part of us? And these are not each independent things. If you look at them, as I believe the research is trying to tell us to look at them, as a whole, you see that over and over again we encounter evidence that some part of consciousness exists outside of time-space.
Does it frustrate you when you talk to scientists and they think everything is physical, the brain is physical, the functioning is all physical, and they don't understand that there's something else out there?
Well, it can be very frustrating, because what usually happens when you talk to people who have very hard opinions about something like this and they dismiss all of the evidence out of hand, when you say to them, well, what specifically is it about, pick the experiment you want, that is wrong? Where is the flaw in this research that invalidates its conclusion? And over again, you find out, well, they've never actually bothered to read any of the research. They just have an attitude about it. And yes, there are a significant number of people who are sort of paradigm bound, I guess. They go into reality vertigo when you talk to them or show them information that doesn't conform with their idea of the way the world works. But people do change. You know, Carl Sagan went through a significant change. He began as a complete physicalist, and in his last book, he made a point of saying there are several areas of non-local consciousness. That's not the way he describes it. He says there are several areas of research which need to have serious study, and he lists these. These are all non-local consciousness research areas. People do change as they are exposed to the information, if they will take the time and have a sufficiently open mind to actually look at the data.
Now I put you on the spot, Stephen. How did it come about?
How did what come about?
This consciousness.
Where does consciousness begin?
Uh-huh.
I think to answer that question properly, George, I'd have to have sandals and a robe.
That's right. You're close. You're close.
My personal feeling, My personal feeling is that consciousness predates physicality. Only date is wrong. You see, part of the problem with this is that it's almost impossible to have a conversation about it because so much of our language is time-space bound. In Opening to the Infinite, when I wrote that book, I got all the way through it. And I read it. I sat down one night to read it just to sort of get a sense of it because when you write a book, you write each chapter and you kind of lose, you know, it just becomes very intense.
Yeah, you're looking for flow.
Yeah, and so you're... And I began to read it, and I realized that I had to rewrite the whole book because my language was entirely time-space bound. You know, it's the idea that there's a signal, that there's a sender, that there's a receiver, all those sort of electromagnetic models. It's the wrong way to conceptualize it. It's about opening. I think the evidence is telling us that it's as if we are fish swimming around in a sea, if you will, of interconnectedness. And we don't bring it up to our conscious mind, but it's there just beneath the surface. And it emerges periodically, particularly in moments of high stress or high emotion, which is why people see ghosts or they have premonitions, that sort of thing. I tend to believe now that consciousness is causal and physicality is its manifestation.
You know, every time I see a picture that Hubble has taken or one of these incredible new pieces of satellite machinery we've got, I think about what you just said, and that is the fact that consciousness was around way before any of this even started. What I can't figure out, and like you just said, you need a sandals and a robe, is the design for this. This couldn't happen by accident, Stephen.
Yeah, actually, you know, I was in a debate not long ago between evolutionists and creationists.
You were right in the middle.
And I was actually right in the middle because I asked both of them. I said to the creationist, what is it about evolution that violates your understanding of deity?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why can't God have set evolution in
motion?
Yes, I mean, the cells operate in a certain way. I mean, what is it that precludes God from having created evolution? And I asked the evolutionist, what is it in evolution that precludes some intelligent design that set the whole thing in motion? And neither one of them had an answer for this.
Which means you are the correct one.
Well, I think so. I think we need to get less, we need to get out of our boxes and really sort of take off the blinders and look at what the evidence is trying to tell us. And that is that all consciousness is, I believe, is interconnected and interdependent. I mean, we know from these studies that have been done, for instance, the therapeutic intent studies where with conscious intention, somebody causes another system to, another organism, whether it's a cell colony or insects or small animals or people, to create effects. It all suggests that there is some kind of linkage that's going on. Otherwise, how would it happen? I just think we're being driven to look at the world in a very different way.
Do you think, Stephen, if there's life out there on other planets, life like ours, we've got probably a pretty good chance of guessing that they have consciousness too, that they're all tapped into what we're tapped into?
Yes. I think at some level, this is all interconnected. I just think the idea that we are the only sentient species in the universe, in the many universes,
the multiverses.
Yeah, I mean, it's so preposterous. It's such an act of arrogant hubris that I just find it, I can't take it seriously. I mean, as you say, if you look at the Hubble images, for instance, and you realize that you're looking at millions and millions of planets, how can you possibly think that we're the only people?
When we're beginning to find out, just in our own solar system, that the complexities of other planets is very similar. I think we've got the big gas planets and we've got the smaller ones, but we're beginning to find liquid methane, frozen methane, liquid water. I mean, the similarities are incredible. I think the little organisms that we're all part of are all over the place.
I think you're right. How did life begin on Earth? What was it that quickened it? I mean, it's not immediately apparent that it's some sort of chemical reaction or anything remotely like that. And when they began trying to create artificial intelligence with computers, thinking that the neural networks of computers would mimic the brain, it turns out it just doesn't work like that. I think that there are many levels of information that we are only just very tentatively beginning to be aware of.
The man or woman who's trying to make a living for their families, for their loved ones, they go to work, they get their paycheck, they live in a nice house, a small house, no house, who knows? They have a television and a radio, maybe none. But they try to make a living. They're trying to carve out an existence on this planet as well as they can. What does this all mean to them if they are able to understand what we're going to talk about tonight? And that's the consciousness and the ability to be aware.
Well, I think what you get out of it at just the simplest practical level is that once you begin seeing that all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent, and you recognize that, and that the interaction of these linkages of consciousness create fields. That's a hand-waving term, I admit it, but for want of a better term, fields. My friend Rupert Sheldrake calls them morphogenetic fields.
Right. Lynn McNaggart calls it the field.
The field, yeah. I mean, there are lots of ways of approaching this. It's a kind of organizing that's created by intention. And when you realize that, let me give it to you in another historical experience of mine. I lived through Watergate.
Me too.
I was in government. I knew many of the people that were involved. I was the special assistant to a man named Elmo Zumwalt at that time. And as I met all these various kinds of people and I watched Watergate unfold both from the inside and the outside, as it were, I came to believe that Watergate really was all the pencils everybody had stolen from the office. It was the aggregate. It was a kind of...
It was all of it.
Yes, we are all complicit in this. That's the part that's hard for people to, I think, both understand and accept, is that they are empowered, because there's so many things in our experience in life that tell us we're unempowered. But if you look at what's going on in the world today, I mean, let me give you an example. If you look at the jihadists, for instance, what motivates them? It's a shared idea. It's a shared perspective that leads them to make small individual choices. These are quite ordinary people. It has them making particular kinds of choices. If you look at national character, I mean, if you fly in an airplane in Europe across between France and Germany, there's nothing when you look down out of the airplane that says this part is France and this part is Germany. There's no line that you see on the ground. And yet no Frenchman would ever mistake himself for a German or would be taken for a German and the other way around. Why? Because of thousands and thousands and thousands of little acts of choice that create the culture that these people are embedded in, the choices about what foods you eat, what music you listen to, what drink you drink, how you get married, how you get buried, how you treat your children. All of those thousands and thousands of little mundane daily decisions in aggregate create national character.
Stephen, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment as we get into now opening to the infinite. Specifically, we're going to talk about remote viewing and some death experiences, and I can't wait until it's phone time with you. I'll be back. And our special guest tonight, Stephen Schwartz, as we talk about remote viewing in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, was that Admiral Zumwalt that you worked with?
Yes.
Ah, Okay, I spent 9 years in the Navy and remember his name well, though he was before my time. He was in there with the Rickovers, that kind of reputation.
That's exactly right, yes. Yes, I was his speechwriter and a sort of in-house civilian think tank. And I knew Admiral Rickover and almost wrote a biography of him.
Rickover was a genius. I did get that book. Somebody did write a biography on
him. They did. The guy that was originally my researcher, Norman Bulmar. And another fellow, Tim Allen, who worked at Geographic, wrote it.
Not the comedian.
No. Well, very nice guy, but no, not the comedian.
Did Zumwalt ever admit to you about underwater UFO bases or anything like that?
No. But I will tell you something quite interesting. I when I got into that post, when I was asked to do that, I decided that I would look at the Philadelphia experiment.
Aha! Tell me
whether it was for real or not.
What'd you find out?
Well, I mean, and I had I had the clearances I could get at stuff, and so I really looked into it. It never happened. That's the headline. What did happen was that the Navy became very concerned about magnetic mines, and they began running a series of tests at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. They built a degaussing wharf, which was basically big electromagnets, and they would take the ships through these magnetic fields with the idea that this would change their magnetic alignment.
Okay, all right.
Right, make them less susceptible to the mines. And, of course, somebody had to be aboard the ship. And in those days, we're speaking here in very early, people didn't really understand the effects that living organisms had when they were placed in big magnetic fields.
Right.
They just didn't know very much about it. And so there were cases of sailors on the skeleton crew that took the, I can't think of the name of the destroyer that was...
Eldridge. The Eldridge.
Right. And that took the Eldridge through. The story traces back to a man named Ivan Sanderson, whom I knew, and who used to write sort of popular books about paranormal
yes.
and sort of weird things.
He was one of the best at his time.
Yeah, he was very good. This is in the 50s, up in the early 60s. He's long dead now. And Ivan was told this story by somebody at the Pentagon who waved some sort of paper in front of him. Anyway, he was never very clear. And in those days when I first met him, I was much younger and I couldn't press him, but so hard. But anyway, the story traces to him and he wrote it up. And then Charlie Berlitz from the mm-hmm. son of the founder of the Berlitz School of
right.
Languages.
Who went on to write about the Bermuda Triangle.
That's
and
right.
Like that. Yeah.
And Atlantis. Yeah. Charlie, who spoke 32 languages and was a very interesting guy. He picked up from Ivan and he wrote a book about it, which popularized it even more.
I remember reading that book.
Yeah.
Drove me crazy. I loved it.
And then it was picked up and a television program was made about it. Rod Serling was involved with it. And it just sort of became an urban legend.
And then a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So I climbed up inside of it. I got all of the original records, the logs of the Eldridge. I went and actually interviewed people who were in the Philadelphia Navy Yard at that time.
This is incredible. I mean, it happened, but not the way they say it happened.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. What happened was men did go through high energy magnetic fields. It did produce strange psychotic behaviors, as it does.
Yes.
There's now a whole literature on this. And the ship didn't disappear. Nobody walked through walls.
People didn't get, meshed into the into the boat or anything like that.
Right.
The ship.
So, I mean, it just, I'll tell you an even better one, the one that's in Opening to the Infinite that I told, and I don't think anybody's ever put together before, and that is how the American government got into the non-local consciousness research game.
All right, tell us. I love these stories.
What happened was, and this is in Opening to the Infinite, what happened was a guy named Mazière, who was a French journalist, wrote in an obscure French periodical saying that the American Navy had carried out an experiment aboard the nuclear submarine Nautilus, which was the very first nuclear submarine, and that they had established this telepathy connection, as he described it. So he wrote this up, and the KGB read it, and they took it seriously. So they began, they thought, well, God, if the Americans are doing this kind of research, we better get started. And they already had an interest in it. Notably, there were some very prominent and very, very fine scientists, a man named Vasiliev, for instance, who began testing whether this kind of consciousness is electromagnetic. And he began the experiments, which I finally finished with the submarine experiment Deep Quest, which is also in the book, and the whole story of that. But anyway, the KGB took it seriously, and so they set up a program. And in due course, the American intelligence community began, through their human intelligence network, they began to get wind of this program. And so they went back and said, well, my God, if the Russians are taking this seriously, we got to take it seriously. And so that's how they approached Hal Puthoff, who was then a Naval Intelligence Reserve officer mm-hmm. and a laser physicist, and Russ Targ. And that's how the SRI program got started. And so when you trace it all back, you find out that a bogus
story
written by Mazier, he worked with another writer, and they wrote a book called Morning of the Magician. And I went back and tracked, he wasn't alive anymore, but I tracked his partner down, who told me part of this. And so on the basis of a bogus story in an obscure French periodical, the Soviet intelligence apparatus began to put together a consciousness research program, which in turn was picked up by the Americans, and it was all based on a bogus experiment on an American submarine that never happened.
Jeez. It almost backfired on us.
Well, I just like the irony of each side beginning something on the belief of the other side, all made up by this utterly obscure French journalist. I mean, Mazier, nobody in the States had ever heard of him. This little journal that he published in this small circulation, and yet because it was considered to be a genuine leak that he had gotten hold of, all everything that flowed out of it subsequently that we're all talking about, and out of it came the one school of the development of remote viewing.
How did you key, though we talk about a lot of things in the book, Opening to the Infinite, how did you key in on remote viewing, or why?
Well, I actually came to it entirely on my own based on studying the Edgar Cayce material. I got interested in the aspects of the Cayce material which could be validated. I mean, that you could really find evidential material about it. And as I looked at it, I began to ask myself, well, what is it that how does he get this information? I mean, where does he go? And who stores it? How does it get stored? Where does it come from? Because I knew it to be highly accurate. You asked me earlier, what got me interested in all this? One of the things is that I went down to Virginia Beach, and I was taken up by someone that I had met to look at the Cayce material. I'd never heard of him. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know anything about any of this. And I had been working for National Geographic before I'd been drafted. This is all back in the Vietnam era, and early Vietnam era. And I pulled off the shelf a notebook with his readings, and it had a reading that he gave in 1936 for a woman in which he said she had been a member of the Essene community, and he described where this community was, and I recognized it as Kirbit Qumran, and he said she had been a teacher of astrology.
All right.
And the hair stood straight up on my head, because the last thing I had done for the Geographic before I went into the service was research on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so it was a subject I was conversant with. And I knew that in 1936, nobody knew that Kirbit Qumran existed. Nobody knew that there were women who were part of the Essene community, and nobody knew that the Essenes were interested in astrology, which is what he said, that she was a teacher of astrology.
So this really woke you up.
Absolutely, because I thought, it was not until 1947 that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered by a young Bedouin herdsman who chucked a rock in a cave mouth and heard it hit something and went in to look, and that's how the scrolls were discovered.
They were just sitting in there all these years.
In these urns that they were
in.
And I knew that the scrolls themselves talked about this fascination with astrology, and that excavations at Kirbit Qumran, which at that point was thought to be a minor outpost of the Emperor Vespasian's legions that had been built for the Jewish uprising in AD 68, and nobody had ever thought of it as an Essene community. The Essenes were described by Josephus, who was the main source of information about them, as this schismatic monastic order of Jewish monks, all men, who lived out in the desert. And so I thought, well, how could Casey possibly have known that there were women in the community? There were, where the skeletons were found. How could he have known about the interest in astrology? The scrolls themselves speak of it. How could he have known that Kirbit Qumran was, in fact, an Essene community? I mean, that information lay 11 years in the future. And so I thought, well, you know, I called it distant viewing for about 15 years.
Okay.
Until I met, I didn't meet Hal and Russ until 1976, I guess, when I invited them to take part in the submarine experiment. And so from 67, 68, when I was doing this research, to 10 years later, I called this distant viewing. And I got interested in studying it from the point of view of archaeology, because I wanted to develop an experiment that that would be interesting enough to be successful, that didn't just rely on a statistical analysis, because people find statistics hard to understand, whereas if you can find Cleopatra's palace, you know, it kind of cuts through the chase. And
like they just found Herod's tomb.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And so I got interested in developing a technique for using it in archaeology. And as I began to do research on that, I discovered that people had been doing it actually for about 100 years, going back to Frederick Bligh Bond, who reconstructed Glastonbury Cathedral, and Stefan Osowiecki in Poland, who worked with a man named Poniatowski, who was the leading ethnographer of Poland during the war, and whose experiments they took so seriously that even though at the risk of being killed if they were discovered, because if you were, archaeology in Poland was outlawed by the Nazis, and if they caught you practicing it, they killed you.
Even though Hitler dabbled in the occult.
But he had a point of view. See, he was looking for his occult, you know, the spear of Longinus and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they didn't want to have any early man research that was coming out that would contradict their construction about how the world, you know, the history of the world. So they just wouldn't allow anybody to do it. And I mean, they wouldn't. In one case that I tracked down, an archaeologist was getting married, and the Nazis came in and dragged him out of the church in the middle of the ceremony and put the bride, the groom, the priest, and the entire wedding party up against the wall of the church and machine gun.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, to carry out these experiments during the war, during occupied Warsaw, was a serious deal. And yet, a whole group of scientists accompanied by Poniatowski, or led by Poniatowski, carried out these experiments with Osowiecki about early man research in Poland. And then I found the great Olmec head that, you know, you used to see on the tequila ads, and a number of other things were all uncovered by a man named Clarence Woolsey Wyatt, and he used a shaman as a remote viewer, or as I called it then, a distant viewer. So I gradually put together the stories of 100 years of research, and that became the book, The Secret Vaults of Time.
Okay.
So then I've carried it on from there, but I originally was just looking for a way of doing an experiment that I thought had a high probability of success, because it's exciting to do this kind of work, and that makes a difference. And that would give unequivocal results that you just couldn't argue about.
Steve, we're going to talk a lot about remote viewing when we turn the corner here at the top. But let me ask you this. The Spear of Destiny, of course, that Hitler was looking for. Why was he so interested in that?
Well, because it traces back to a book written by a man named Johann Walter Stein, who was disciple's not the right word, who was a follower of Rudolf Steiner, the founder of anthroposophy. And Stein wrote a manuscript which the Nazis got hold of and which traces a kind of occult history. It's sort of like Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
There's some kind of legend behind the spear, isn't
yes,
there?
Yes, that Longinus pierced the spear, and that whoever would control the spear could rule the world.
Right, right, right.
And so Hitler was determined to find it, and also all these other things that were mentioned by Stein in his manuscript, which was later, by the way, picked up by a man named Trevor Constable, who wrote a book called The Spear of Destiny. And that's what really brought it into modern consciousness.
Do you think, has it been found? It's in a museum somewhere,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that they have it on display. I haven't looked into it for years now, but they have what they think is the spear. I mean, you know.
Well, now, let me ask you this. Can they look at that spear? Is there still blood on it? And can they...
Oh, yes.
You know where I'm headed here.
Of course. Can you get Jesus' DNA?
Yes.
That is actually a very interesting question, and you know I don't know the answer to that. When I was looking into all of this stuff, and I knew Trevor Constable, and I met Stein's at Emerson College in England, a very elderly man had been a very close friend of Stein's, and he had given him the manuscript. There were only two copies, and he gave it to me to read. When all of that was going on, that's pre-DNA, and I haven't really looked at this question since the development of DNA, and so I don't actually know the answer, but you know, the latest work on the shroud is causing everybody to re-examine the shroud again, so... You raise a very interesting point.
That would be fascinating. Stephen, you've got a number of websites, but this brand new book, Opening to the Infinite, is it out yet?
It is out. You have a copy.
Well, I have a copy. I thought you might have given me the pre-copy, but this is it, huh?
No, that's it.
Okay.
The book is out, and I spent the last 3 years writing it. I've rewritten it a number of times. It says everything I know about the subject of non-local consciousness, and it also contains very explicit instructions about how to get in touch with this part of yourself. I tried to make it so that it was very accessible to people and that anybody could follow the real simple instructions, and they would be able to have these experiences and be able to prove them to themselves that they'd actually done it.
Well, this is fascinating. Websites, so I've got a whole handful of them. Which ones do you recommend?
To get the book, you can go to Amazon. You can go to my own personal website, stephanaschwartz.com. That's STEPHANASCHWARTZ. You all have very graciously, I think, put it up on your website.
Of course. It's the least we could do for you, Steve.
Absolutely. And my daily web publication is theschwartzreport.net. And that's a daily web publication I do every day. It doesn't have any cost. And it's not only about this. It's about trends that are shaping the future.
All right. Stay with us. Stephen Schwartz, our special guest. Now we're going to really get into remote viewing in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. So don't touch your dial.